Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, we talked to U.S. Senator Alex Padilla about Proposition 1, which is about mental health in California, but also talked to him about the border and potential immigration deal, foreign aid, President Biden's age, the Dodgers, and more. A little bit later, a conversation with the mayor of San Jose for the first time on The Issue Is, Matt Mahan, who discusses Proposition 47 and why he thinks it needs to change. And later, our conversation with civil rights attorney Areva Martin, who is working on a case in Palm Springs where she says reparations are in order after the city essentially burned down a black neighborhood back in the 1960s. But let's start with the senior senator from California, Alex Padilla, and our conversation starts talking about Proposition 1. First, let's play a clip from The Issue Is with Governor Newsom from December.
Most exciting thing I've ever been part of. No BS.
More than anything you've ever been a part of? Why is that?
It touches more people in more ways on more days.
Governor Newsom on The Issue Is talking about Prop 1. It's a $6.3 billion bond that vows to build 11,000 new mental health treatment beds and 27,000 outpatient units for mental health help. Here to talk about Prop 1 and a whole lot more is the senior senator from the state of California, Alex Padilla. Welcome back to The Issue Is. Great to see you.
Good to be back, Alex. Good to be back.
Thanks so much. Okay, so Prop 1, a lot of this is focused on trying to help the homeless, especially homeless who are mentally ill. Right. We have seen so many different things that says they're going to be game changers when it comes to homelessness and mental health. And the situation keeps getting worse. What's different this time? Why should people trust you all this time?
Right. No, it's a great question, but I'm glad you're asking because it helps us make the case for Proposition 1. You know, to set the stage, we've got to look back at a little bit of history here, right? In the 1960s, under different political leadership at the time,
Ronald Reagan,
there used to be state hospitals where people with mental illness were treated. Maybe not the best. Research has come a long way. And they were shut down on the promise that we're going to shut down these state hospitals. These big institutions are not the way to do it. And we're going to replace it with community-based support, community-based services. The hospitals were closed, but the funding for those community-based services never really came. And so we've had this struggle grow and grow over the years, and we're left with what we're dealing with today. So Proposition 1 begins that that big investment in community-based services and support. The other thing that's, I think, smart about the approach is there's a lot of people who talk about homelessness, and not the housing piece of it, but the mental health piece of it. Not everybody who's experiencing homelessness is mentally ill,
sure.
But clearly a lot of people are.
Mm-hmm.
Just like not everybody who is experiencing a mental health condition
is homeless. Right.
But a lot of people are. There's a huge overlap, mm-hmm. and you're not going to address either one without acknowledging both. And that's the lens through which Proposition 1 was crafted.
So real succinctly, how does it work? What does it look like under Proposition 1 that's different than what's happening today?
So, coupled with some pieces of legislation that have gone through in the state budget, what Proposition 1 does is take existing funding that's already supposed to be going towards behavioral health services and give some flexibility, some reprioritization of what the strategies have been for the last 10, 20 years. There is some general obligation bonds to help build housing, right? Really hard to tell people, hey, let's get off the streets without not just housing in terms of a roof over your head, but supportive housing. So housing together with mental health services, if that's what you need, education, access to health care, job training, retraining, if that's what you need, so that people come off the streets sustainably and not temporarily and then back up there.
And we have seen some of these efforts to build housing for the homeless that have been very expensive, often over budget, often late. What is the accountability measures in place here so that doesn't happen again?
So the accountability measures are absolutely there. It was placed in the ballot on a bipartisan basis because of that. Every nickel, every penny is going to be accounted for. And I also have to take a minute to emphasize the dedicated portion of this, which will help veterans. Right. So many veterans who have been willing to make the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of our country, our home, dealing with PTSD or other issues and concerns, get a living on the streets. They deserve better And Proposition 1 will help make sure we're addressing their concerns as well.
Right now, it looks like from the polls that Proposition 1 will pass and there will be some movement on there. Doesn't look like there's a lot of movement when it comes to immigration in the United States Senate. We spoke to you a few weeks ago up in San Jose before this immigration bill came out, this bipartisan bill which had been negotiating for months. A lot of folks on the right thought that it was too easy on migrants. You thought it was too much. You did not like the bill. Why not?
But so, first of all, the context here, there was a quote-unquote border security slash immigration element of the broader package that included funding for Ukraine,
right.
Funding not just for Israel, but the desperately needed humanitarian aid needed for the region, funding for Taiwan, the Indo-Pacific as a region. But the border elements, right? I was supportive of all the other foreign aid elements, but not at the expense of bad immigration policy. We saw some good things in the package, but a lot of very bad things, most notably a return to Title 42 while calling it something else. Mechanisms to attempt to shut down the border, which we know from experience. So during the Trump administration, when Title 42 was in place, numbers of people coming into the United States unlawfully went up.
This Title 42 makes it easier to basically deport people right away.
Right, saying without due process.
And they said it was because of COVID.
And there are people coming to seeking to come to the United States for different reasons. Not everybody around the world who wants to come should get to come immediately or just because. There's got to be order, there's got to be security, but there's also got to be humanity. So for people wanting to come to seek asylum, right? It's not just federal law, but our international obligations that we consider asylum seekers through a fair process. The system today is so overburdened that it takes, you know, years and years to get an answer. It should be really sort of weeks, maybe a couple of months. But the departments, the agencies that have been starved of resources and staffing to have those hearings
Wouldn't that need to be basically a massive inflow of asylum judges, of courthouses built there, of hearings? But you don't do that if you don't pass a border bill, right?
Exactly. Well, and talking to my colleagues, like, what's the ultimate objective here? There's some Republicans who will not be happy until the border is just completely closed, which is completely unrealistic. Mexico's not our number one trading partner. But most people coming to the United States, either seeking asylum or even seeking economic opportunity, which is a different pathway, are coming through Mexico, but not from Mexico. You see people fleeing repressive regimes like Venezuela, like Cuba, other places, trying to make their way here. So we need to restore the asylum system. We need to maybe grow the work visa programs. Every employer I talk to is desperate for more workers. So let's get people who want to come here to work, connect them with employers needing workers, and do it in a lawful, orderly way. But here's the biggest piece, Alex. If we're going to, quote unquote, drive down the numbers, that's what my colleagues kept saying over and over again, we're not going to do it sustainably without engaging the rest of the hemisphere. Our partners, not just Mexico, but Central America, South America. Why are people so desperate to leave and come to the United States in the first place? It would be wise for us to invest in providing that hope and opportunity for folks back home. Or at least to the extent there will be migration, then Mexico will do its part. You know, the Northern Triangle countries will do their part. Central American countries will do their part. Let's have a hemispheric solution to a hemispheric challenge. That was completely lacking in this bill. And last piece, hugely critical. For the first time, a border slash immigration proposal that was put on the table that was completely enforcement only and provided no relief to dreamers, to farm workers, to undocumented essential workers, people who, you know, make this country stronger, make our economy stronger each and every day. We have to get back to that balanced approach.
So at this point, just judging the real politics of this, are we essentially at a place where there is no real path for there to be real immigration deal in the Senate, at least until the election?
Yeah. Look, I got to keep hope alive.
Okay.
This is a tough business if you become too pessimistic. But here's what my bottom line is. I think there is, because we know the ideas that will work. The biggest question is, when are Republicans going to get serious?
Yeah.
Because they've been so hypocritical throughout these negotiations. On the one hand, they say it's a crisis, it's a crisis, we've got to act now. On the other hand, Trump says, wait till November, and they say, yes, sir. Right? On the one hand, they say, well, as we're negotiating, when is Secretary Mayorkas from Homeland Security at the table to make sure it's a meaningful proposal? But on the other hand, they're trying to impeach him.
Well, and let's talk about that now. So there is this effort to impeach Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. He was impeached this week in the House. It now goes to the Senate, where there's a trial. What's that trial going to look like? Because you're going to be one of the jurors.
Right, and I've been through this before. My first week in the Senate 3 years ago was sitting through Trump's second impeachment trial. So we've been through this before. Look, any amount of time and energy the Senate spends on this is a complete waste of time. But given the vote in the House, by one vote, you know, margin, we do have to deal with it. I don't know what the exact process is going to be, but I hope it's a brief one that dismisses this baseless impeachment.
You all in the Senate passed foreign aid this week, which would fund the wars in Israel and in Ukraine. The House saying, we're not going to take this up. If they don't, what happens?
Yeah, well, we're going to have to keep pressing because there's so much at stake. It's not just funding Ukraine in their defense against Putin's aggression. That's hugely critical for democracy, not just for the people of Ukraine. Yes, it would fund Israel in their defense, but just as importantly, I want to emphasize this, humanitarian aid for the region. Because my heart goes out not just to Israeli victims, but all the innocent Palestinians living in Gaza under the oppression of Hamas, right? And so when you see people going without food, going without water, going without health care that they need, that aid is waiting to be delivered. We need the House to get off the ball. And yes, Taiwan, the Indo-Pacific as a region, strengthening our posture there. I got to believe it's going to happen. There's different procedural ways to get through the House. There's regular order, suspension, this and that. But I think the need is too important and too urgent, too critical.
So you think at the end of the day it gets done?
I believe so. There's if this package was brought to the House floor today, overwhelming bipartisan support to get it done. So it's just politics getting in the way of it. And, you know, I had to over-politicize it, but it's the environment that we're in. Here's how I see it. You know, Putin's got something over Trump. That's clear. And Trump has such a hold on the Republican Party. Are there enough Republicans who will stand up to do what's right for America and for democracy to overcome the political pressures of Donald Trump?
You know, that's a big charge, and there's a lot of folks on the right who say that that was never proven. What evidence do you have of that?
Just the way he's acting, the way he's behaving. Well, consider this. I told you I sat through the second impeachment trial of Trump. Do you remember what the first one was about?
It was about Ukraine funding.
He called President Zelensky and said, I'm going to withhold your foreign aid until you open up an investigation or you look into my political rivals. That's what it was about. Mm-hmm. So what is it about Trump and Putin? What is it about Trump and Ukraine? In the meantime, important policy, foreign aid to important allies is on hold. So Republicans, release the hostage. Let's just let the foreign aid go.
So speaking of politics, you know, there's a situation right now where 86% of the country believes that Joe Biden is too old to run for president. 86% of the country doesn't agree on almost anything. Why are they wrong?
Look, maybe it's because they don't see the Joe Biden that I see. Yeah, he's up there in age. That's a number. But as I've had a chance to work with him, engage with him, not just at events, but in the Roosevelt Room in the White House, in the Oval Office itself, he is smart. He's effective. He's a true leader. He's thoughtful. And he's leveraging all that experience and relationship with leaders around the world to our benefit. I mean, you look when Russia invaded Ukraine, people thought it was only a matter of hours before Ukraine would fall. He single-handedly rallied not just NATO, but other allies to help Ukraine. And here we are a couple of years later about to turn the corner. If you look at the economy and the economic environment that we were in when he became president, to think we went from, you know, incredible loss of jobs and a down economy in large part because of the pandemic to record low unemployment, rising wages, inflation on the way down, job creation beyond expectations at every report. He's done a hell of a job, and he's earned more than four more years.
More than 4 more years. Yeah, now we're making news here.
Four more years.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do everything I can to help him achieve that.
But I'm sure you saw John Stewart's criticism this week saying, why don't we see that? Why don't you put that person out there? He's done less press conferences, less town halls, less interviews. We don't see him in a lot of unscripted scenarios. Do you think the White House needs to put him out there more?
So two things. Number one, love John Stewart. You know, you tune into Comedy Central for a good laugh.
Yeah.
Right? You turn into The Issue Is for good insight and reporting.
Okay. I think both is true of both, but okay. Yeah.
No, and here's the other thing. Look at timing. Up until now, everyone's been so focused on the Republican primary. Because we've known all along who our candidate's going to be. It's going to be President Biden seeking a second term. On the Republican side, it's been Donald Trump or Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis, remember that name, and others. Now that there's clarity on the Republican side of who the nominee's going to be, now we're going to see, you know, one-on-one through now and November, and people have the clearest of contrast, the clearest of choices to make between the two.
Well, we would love to have him here, and if you could put in a good word, we'd appreciate it. Let's have some fun as we wrap things up. We know you are a huge Dodger fan.
Yes.
We know you've been out there at
the stadium.
You were part of Fernando Valenzuela's big number ceremony. We've been out at Dodger Stadium with you. There you are showing off that arm. Look at that guy go. That's pretty good.
A little high.
Over the plate. So we've got an opportunity. There he is. Shohei Ohtani for like the biggest Dodger season ever. What are your expectations? What are you looking for? There's a young Alex Padilla when you were on the Dodgers years ago.
Much younger. Yeah, there's a jersey in the office too.
Yeah.
Look, the expectations, like the rest of Dodger Nation, a World Series trophy. No more excuses. The talent is there. Now we just got to deliver.
Don't you feel like you want to just fast forward to the postseason, though, after all these disappointing first season?
No, as much as we're paying these players, yeah. I want all 162
you gotta be
games.
There every time.
I just pray that they stay healthy and are...
I'm sure you'll be out there a lot. I know it was a disappointing week for California sports with the 49ers, but the Dodgers are going to be the ones to do it.
Our thanks to Senator Padilla. Now, let's talk about Prop 47 and potential changes to it. Our next guest is Matt Mahan, the mayor of San Jose. Here's a recent press conference from him.
Like all legislation, Prop 47 was not perfect and has had significant unintended consequences.
San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan joining San Francisco's mayor and some Republican leaders in pushing for a change to California's controversial Prop 47. A reminder, a decade ago, Prop 47 said retail theft under $950 would be considered a misdemeanor instead of a felony. Joining us now from San Jose is Mayor Matt Mahan. Welcome to The Issue Is for the first time.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. So let's put up some information on the screen about what you want to see change with a potential ballot measure in November. So your idea to reclassify theft with two or more prior convictions as jail-eligible felonies. You'd want to add new laws to address some of the smash-and-grab thefts and allow, and this is pretty key, multiple thefts by a single person to reach that $950 threshold to make it a felony. Mr. Mayor, why is this necessary and how would this work?
Sure. Well, let me just back up and say that what we're seeking to do is reform, not repeal Prop 47. I think Prop 47 did important things. It reduced over-incarceration, overcrowding in our jails, and it really forced us to take a second look at how we can improve rehabilitation. So we want to avoid sending folks to jail and prison if we can. It's very expensive and often doesn't make people's lives better. On the other hand, there has to be accountability, and there are two areas where we see significant gaps with the current state of the law. One is about around repeat and organized retail theft. We've all seen the increases and the impact on small businesses. I'm all for second chances, but at some point there have to be consequences. And that consequence probably needs to include jail time in many of these cases to send a message that we're not going to tolerate that level of lawlessness. And then the other is around addiction. We have seen that participation in drug courts has plummeted and overdose deaths have skyrocketed since the passage of Prop 47. I don't solely blame Prop 47, but we need tools for compelling people into treatment, and we need to classify fentanyl as the hard drug that it is. It's addictive and deadly, and we need to treat it as such.
Now, this week, there was a push by Speaker Rivas and some of the other leading Democrats in the state legislature to try to help enforcement when it comes to retail theft, but they said, we don't want to talk about Prop 47 yet. Is your basic point that Prop 47 needs to be talked about now?
I think it does because it was passed by the voters. And while the legislature has taken up some of these issues, generally has failed to pass any relevant changes in recent years. The heart of the matter has to do with whether or not we can escalate the penalties and do things like aggregate theft so that they hit that $950 threshold or classify fentanyl as a hard drug. I mean, these are things that need to go back to the voters, unfortunately, because of how sweeping the reforms were that we passed back in 2014. And again, I don't want to repeal it. I just think we need to do targeted reforms that address these very significant gaps around organized retail theft and the lack of accountability for engaging in treatment when someone is clearly severely addicted to a hard drug like fentanyl.
So you'd like to see a ballot measure in November. We've seen this weird combination of like Democratic mayors and some Republicans on this. Where are we at in terms of making this ballot initiative happen? And do you think you have the votes to pass it?
Well, really, it's a signature gathering effort. And you have a very bipartisan group of moderates from really across the spectrum. You've got DAs and Republican leaders. You also have Democratic mayors who are on the front lines of these dual crises of repeat and organized retail theft, along with the fentanyl crisis that is taking hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in our individual cities. We've seen just a horrible skyrocketing of overdose deaths, and we need better tools for compelling people into treatment. So we're gathering signatures. We need a little over 500,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot in November. I believe the campaign is over 300,000, so we're well on our way, but we would ask folks to get involved, to go out and collect signatures, make sure you've signed on if you want to see these common sense reforms.
All right, this is your first time on our show, and for some people, this is probably an introduction to you for the statewide audience and outside of the Bay Area. Can you tell us a little bit about your story and how you got to be mayor?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a small farming town on the Central Coast, a town called Watsonville, which is where your strawberries come from. And I got to know San Jose, where I'm now very proud to be mayor, because I came as a high school student. I was a work-study scholarship student coming from a working-class background, got a chance to go to a college prep Catholic school, which changed my life. And I really fell in love with the city of San Jose for its diversity, its economic vitality. Of course, the 300 days of sunshine we have a year. There's a lot to recommend it. And I always knew I wanted to come back. So I went off to college, came back, was a public school teacher, got into the tech sector. And all along, I just felt that we really need to get our public policies right. The biggest limitation to our future prosperity really run through public policies. Are we going to allow more housing? Will we invest in infrastructure? Will we do what it takes to make our city safe and clean and get people housed? And that really became a passion point for me. So when my startup was sold, I ultimately decided to throw my hat in the ring and run for local office. I ran for city council a few years ago.
And San Jose doesn't get the respect that it deserves. The third biggest city in California, bigger city than San Francisco. Right. And so San Jose needs to be paid attention to more, which is why we're glad to be talking to you.
I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm not going to disagree with you. Largest city in the Bay Area, in all of Northern California, in fact.
All right, so we play a game called Personal Issues. This is where we put 30 seconds up on the clock, and we get to know some of your cultural favorites. This is the first thing that comes to mind. Rapid fire. Let's have some fun. And let's start with, what is your favorite TV show?
Oh, boy. Well, I was really into Game of Thrones, I got to admit. So we're a little past that now, but that was a good one.
The ending was terrible, though. Favorite book?
Yeah, I agree with you.
Favorite book?
For Whom the Bell Tolls, Hemingway.
What's your favorite sports team?
San Francisco Giants.
What's your favorite song?
Oh, boy. You know, I grew up listening to Tupac and California Love, so I'll go with that.
Our thanks to Mayor Mahan. Now, a conversation with Areva Martin, talking about something in Palm Springs known as Section 14. Here's some of their recent ad.
Section 14 survivors are residents who actually lived on Section 14.
Attorney Areva Martin is bringing light to the story of Section 14, a dark chapter in California's history. Areva is with us now, who's been with us since the week one of this show. Great to see you, my old friend.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
All right. What is Section 14? Tell us about this history during this Black History Month.
Yes. Yeah, so Section 14 is a location in Palm Springs, basically downtown Palm Springs. It's 646 acres, 1 square mile of property that is, like I said, pretty much adjacent to downtown Palm Springs. And in the 50s and 60s, as African Americans and Latinos were moving into Palm Springs, many in search of an opportunity to build homes, buy homes, create a new life for their families, many escaping Jim Crowism of the South. Palm Springs at the same time is building itself as this desert location. So they had a need for laborers. These workers had a need for jobs. So it's a perfect marriage. But Palm Springs, like many other cities throughout California and throughout the country in that time period, had very, very hostile, racially restrictive covenants as it related to housing. So Black families couldn't live anywhere in Palm Springs. They were confined to certain communities. And it was this 646 acres of land that was owned by the indigenous tribe, the Aquacaliente. Those individuals, the tribal owners, allow the Black and brown families to live in this area, to build homes, to bring homes from other locations, and to create what became this very thriving community.
Until the city stepped in and said, get out. And then they literally burned down their homes, right?
Yeah, it's a really horrific story. And it's amazing that so many people don't even know the history of Palm Springs. Yes, the city as this thriving desert location is becoming more popular with tourists and international travelers. They discover they have a little problem. And that little problem to them is that the Black and brown community that is thriving is in the heart of now what is becoming this thriving, you know, downtown area with bars and restaurants. And so they needed to get rid of these families. I mean, short and simple, that's what they did. And they used their sheer force and might, the city fire department, to actually go in and burn the homes, burn the communities. And then they would go in with bulldozers and just demolish these communities. And for 60 years, Alec, they kept this well-kept secret. The narrative around what happened to Section 14 was pretty much dictated to and led by those who were aligned with the then mayor, Frank Bogart. And they basically made the families who were upended believe that they had done something wrong, that it was their fault that their community was upended. But we know differently. There was a Attorney General's report from that very same time period. Attorney General from California went in, did an investigation, a scathing report, calling it a city-engineered Holocaust.
And years later, as you and others have been bringing this up in the last few years, the mayor of Palm Springs, other council members on Palm Springs, acknowledged that the city was wrong.
Yes.
But they haven't done anything about it. And that's where you step in as a civil rights attorney. You've been trying to get $2 billion for these people. And I know you're in the midst of a negotiation with the city. What do you want and how is that going?
Yeah, so let me just back up on the $2 billion. So when I got hired by the survivors and descendants, I have over 1,000 clients. There had never been a harms assessment. No one had ever gone in to assess what was the harm done to these families. So I brought in a noted economist, and that's what she did. So the $2 billion is the harm assessment that would typically be done after a hurricane or earthquake. So we haven't asked the city to give these families $2 billion. But what we've said is, let's negotiate restitution for the families, recognizing the value of the harm that was done to them. And some folks have tried to twist that into saying we want to bankrupt the city, that we're trying to take, you know, money from the city. And it's the exact opposite. What we've been doing is working in a collaborative way, trying to with the city to help it understand how doing right by these families is also doing right by the city.
And so how is that going?
Well, I will tell you that it has been really hard work. We've been working now for almost 2 years since that apology was issued from the city and the city council. We've been activating. We've been galvanizing people in the region. We've been building strong collaborative and coalition partners. We had come to pretty much a standstill in terms of our negotiations. And starting in December, November of last year, We had to take some more aggressive actions. So we started a public awareness campaign that involved placing some strategic billboards as you enter Palm Springs, because we wanted people to know what the history of this region is. And it's not fair for tourists to think Palm Springs is all sunshine, golf courses, and palm trees. People need to know about the true history of Palm Springs. I'll tell you that, plus Barbara Boxer, our former U.S. Senator, who actually has had a house in the desert for many years, who has come out in support of the city making these families whole. So combination of those billboards, our public awareness campaign, someone as influential as our senator speaking up, we have now gotten the city back to the negotiation table. So we are back now talking, and we are hopeful. It's the beginning. You know, negotiations can be tough. There are lots of starts and stops, but we are back at the table, and we are hoping. And let me just say this, Ellick. This isn't about, again, this isn't a money grab. This isn't families just wanting to take from the city. My clients love Palm Springs, and what we've come up with is a very creative set of proposals, which, in our estimation, are going to help drive more tourists, more dollars, and increase the economic base of the city.
What would you like to see?
Well, one of the things that is at the heart of our proposal is a racial healing center, is to literally develop in Palm Springs a healing center where we can bring in thought leaders, where we can bring in artists, we can bring in religious leaders, and we can talk about racial strife. We know African Americans and Latinos often have strife in this city and in this state. We've seen it. The LGBT community, which is very influential in Palm Springs. There are those that, you know, oppose that community. The Palestinian and the Jewish community. There's so many communities that we think would benefit from this. And this is a center that could be funded not just with city dollars, but also with state dollars, with federal dollars, philanthropic dollars, universities. So we're proposing things like that that will make Palm Springs a heritage tourism location. So we think that by doing right by these families, making them whole, that we also have an opportunity to be a model for the state. We know the state's going through its own kind of reconciliation process with its history with slavery. And we see Palm Springs as being able to lead the state and become a model that many other states, many other states across the country, and then cities even in California can follow.
So that's how you see it fitting into the state model. And what have you heard back in terms of the state on that front?
Well, a lot of positivity, a lot of positive things. Senator Steve Bradford, who is on the reparations task force for the state, he issued an op-ed, again, encouraging City Council of Palm Springs to do the right thing. Palm Springs is mentioned in one of the bills that has been proposed as a part of the reparations package that was introduced into the legislature this season, or this legislative period. But we think that this is something that the governor Newsom could get behind, that the entire Democratic Party legislature could get behind, because they are looking for ways to implement some of the proposals that came out of that 1,000-page reparations report.
Well, and some of the criticism on the reparations debate, whenever you have it, is this idea that you're talking about slavery. These are people that are long dead. I have nothing to do with this. Why are we talking about this? But this is a situation where a lot of these people are alive.
Yes.
This is a situation where there is a way to make them whole. This is something very specific where it's clear there was a wrong and there is a way to make it right.
Yes.
So this is different than some of the statewide debate over this, and seems like it would be an easier political win for the governor.
Very different, very narrowly tailored solution to, as you said, a very specific problem that's well documented by the Attorney General, is also well documented by the Palm Springs Human Rights Commission as well. So we do believe it can be something that the governor and the legislature could wrap their arms around and use it, though, as a model for how to come up with some creative solutions. Because you're right, people get really freaked out when they hear the word reparations, because they're always thinking about what is it going to cost. They never think about how we can benefit as a community, as a city, and as a state. And that's what we've been doing. We've been doing that hard work of being creative in solutions.
And there was a situation at Bruce's Beach in Manhattan Beach, which had been taken from the Bruce family. It's something where they were able to give that property back. The state was involved in that. So this is sort of a similar
state,
situation.
State, the county, yes. And again, that. Very narrowly yeah. tailored solution to Bruce's Beach in the same way. But Bruce's Beach involved one family.
Right.
This I represent over 1,000 men and women. So it's a very different situation, but again, a great opportunity for the state.
So while I have you, I can't help but ask you about the Ms. Trump verdict, which came in towards the end of the week.
Yes.
This idea that he has to pay over $300 million or his company has to pay over $300 million for essentially lying about what the net worth of the company is. We would usually turn to you as our legal analyst. So while you're here,
Absolutely.
Your take on that.
Not surprised by it. We knew for a while that the decision was likely to come down this week and it was likely to be today. And we knew from the testimony that was given throughout that trial and from some of the comments and the rulings by the judge that it wasn't going to be good for the Trump team. We knew that Letitia James had put forth an incredibly strong case and made the case for the kinds of damages that we see coming out today. So you add that $300+ million with the 83+ million civil judgment just handed down in the E. Jean Carroll case. Donald Trump clearly has issues. And we can't forget, yesterday, March 25th, has been set for the first criminal trial mm-hmm. ever of a former U.S. president. And that's just in one
yeah,
of the criminal
cases.
This is
cases. The hush money, porn star payment
which
scandal,
has been recharacterized by the district attorney in Manhattan as also an election interference case. You know, we all call it the hush money case,
yeah.
but that DA has made it very clear that this is a very serious case about election interference.
And so just to wrap things up on the Palm Springs discussion, there is a prayer vigil
yes.
being held this weekend, especially for our viewers on ABC in Palm Springs, a Sunday. And folks can come out and be a part of this event as well.
Yes, we're asking all of the houses of worship in Palm Springs to join us on Sunday, February 18th, for a moment of prayer during their services, and then at 3 o'clock to come to the Church of St. Paul in the Desert, an Episcopalian church led by an incredible team, Reverend Dan Klein and his wife, Jessie Thompson. We have the new president of Operation Push coming in, Dr. Frederick Haynes. He's going to be our guest speaker. And this is a part of the work we've been doing, Alec, is building coalitions with clergy, Stonewall, Democrats of the Desert, Brothers of the Deserts, and other coalition partners, because people in Palm Springs, they want to see the city do the right thing. And we did an MLK march on MLK Day in Palm Springs. It's the first ever social justice march in that city. And we had a standing room only crowd, intergenerational, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-denominational, all coming together to say, now is the right time to do the right thing.
Our thanks to Areva Martin and to Mayor Mahan and to Senator Padilla and to you for listening. Next week, we get even closer to this primary election. Ballots are out now. We encourage you to vote March 5th, the last day to do that. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for listening to The Issue Is. We'll see you next time with more.